This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Freitag ist Euro-Jackpot-Tag. Jetzt im Jackpot rund 73 Millionen Euro. Das Leben könnte so Jackpot sein. In jeder Lotto-Annahmestelle und auf lottobayern.de. Lotto Bayern, nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18, Chance auf den Höchstgewinn 1 zu 140 Millionen. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bzga.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
It was like a scene from the Boxing Day sales, except the much-filmed queue in Bristol was not people desperate for a cut-price fridge, but people desperate to sign on to an NHS dentist practice which had just opened in the area. It was a pictorial expression of an increasingly worrying problem, the sheer difficulty of finding affordable dentistry in many parts of England, with the knock-on effects that has on the health of the community. This week, the government announced a new plan to tackle the situation with the promise of more money to incentivise dentists to work for the NHS and to get them to relocate to so-called dental deserts. But will this plan go any significant way to solving the problem? To answer that, we have to ask why these chronic shortages of NHS dentistry have arisen in the first place, and is it possible that we need to rethink the whole business of providing and funding dentistry? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start by finding out exactly what dental care is available on the NHS and how this has changed over time. Becky Baird is Senior Fellow at the King's Fund. Becky Baird, when did the NHS first start offering dental treatment?
Dentistry was part of the NHS offer from 1948. In fact, one of the earliest problems was that when the NHS and Care Act was passed in 1946, people then waited 2 years to say that we're going to get their free dentistry in 1948. And it was very, very quickly overwhelmed. At that point, you didn't have to pay a contribution. But then by 1951, it was very clear that something would have to be done because the NHS had absolutely performed more dentistry than it was expecting. So they introduced charges first for dentures and then for other care.
How does the system of funding work? And I suppose the first question is, who actually employs dentists?
Dentists, in general, are private businesses. There are some dentists who work in hospitals providing complex surgery or maxillofacial surgeons. And there is a small amount of dentistry provided in the NHS, usually for people with quite severe special needs, people with learning difficulties and that kind of thing. It's a small amount of community dentistry. But the vast majority of dentistry is provided by private contractors who contract their services to the NHS.
NHS doctors don't get money per treatment, but dentists do.
Yes, GPs are paid a weighted capitation fee. That means that they get a certain amount of money per patient, which is slightly adjusted depending on the nature of the patients in their population. And they provide all your care for that flat fee. It's about £100 a year, roughly, for a GP. Dentists don't get a capitated fee for you. They just get paid based on treatments that they provide to you, and that's banded rather than for individual treatments. Patients also pay charges to those treatments, but those charges, although they're paid to the dentist, the charges go to the NHS and form part of the NHS budget. They're not direct payments to the dentist.
Now, how's this changed over the years?
So there's been about sort of three major phases of contract change since the inception of NHS dentistry. At the beginning, dentists were paid a fee for service. That's at a point, of course, where dental healthcare was very different. When the war finished, about 70% of adults didn't have any teeth. The years where you get all your teeth out on your 21st birthday and have a full set of dentures. So very different. There was a big set of contract reforms in 1990, which introduced a certain element of capitation at that point. So dentists would get about 20% of their income for having a registered list to try and encourage them to do more preventive work. And then a really complex set of charges for fee-for-service. And then again in 2006, a new contract was brought in which removed the capitation and introduced these bands, which they call units of dental activity. Units of dental activity. There's different bands of treatment. So a preventive treatment, so a checkup would attract one UDA, one unit of dental activity. A complex crown would attract maybe three units of dental activity or more. So it's a complicated system. There's a minimum fee for a unit of dental activity, but actually it's negotiated based on all kinds of complex historical things locally. So some dentists might get £40 for a UDA, some will get 28.
Is it the same for all the regions and national regions of the UK?
There are similarities between the different countries, but they all operate slightly differently and the charging's different.
Can we talk about how the model of funding creates incentives or disincentives to dentists to offer treatment on the NHS?
Dentists are contracted to perform a number of UDAs over the year. For example, they might be able to offer 1,000 UDAs to their patients. If they overperform on that contract, so they provide, say, 120% of what they said they would, they don't get paid for that extra. If they underperform, the money can get taken back by NHS England and the local commissioners. And we've seen that happen this year, that a lot of the money going into dentistry, because the dentists haven't been able to provide all the UDAs they said they would, that money is clawed back by the NHS. It makes a lot of uncertainty for the dentist.
So if the situation for a patient is slightly more complex than they thought it was going to be, does that mean that they could end up losing out?
Yes.
And therefore, if you don't know whether a patient is going to be complex or not, but you suspect that they might be, might that act as a disincentive from seeing that patient?
Yes, it might. Once you've accepted them, you have to provide the full treatment as well to the end of the treatment course. That's part of the contract. So once you've said you will take a look at somebody and see what needs to be done, it may be that the reimbursement that you get doesn't cover the entire cost of that treatment.
So actually, you've got quite an incentive not to see somebody who you think might have complex dental needs that would take your UDAs beyond a kind of certain level.
Yes, although if you were under your UDAs, you might want to take them on because you want to find a way of getting the money. It's just a really complicated system. At the King's Fund where I work, we've had a lot of us with a lot of experience in the NHS and contracting looking at the dental contract, and we find it incredibly hard to understand. So it's an incredibly complex contract. What we do know is it doesn't seem to be meeting the needs of the dentists because they're not happy, nor does it seem to be meeting the needs of patients because patients aren't getting the access they want to dentistry.
Now, how does the money a dentist can get from private patients differ from that they can get from an NHS one? And I suppose what that comes down to is, do they have to worry about UDAs with private patients, or do they just say, this is how much money I want from this particular service and how much I think it's worth?
Absolutely. They don't have any restrictions. And unlike GPs, so GPs aren't allowed to provide both private and NHS care within the same practice to the same group of patients. For dentists, they can provide both private and NHS care to the same group of people and to the same patients.
Now, can I just ask whether or we have effectively, therefore, not just a two-tier system, but effectively a three and even more tier system when it comes to dental treatment in England?
Dental treatment in England is incredibly inequitable. There are areas of the country which are dental deserts. We know that that's partly to do with where...
Dental deserts.
Dental deserts.
That's just where there's no dentistry.
Where there's no dentists. Partly that's to do with where dental schools are. So there's no dental schools in the east of England. So the east of England's particularly low on dentistry because people often stay where they train. In rural and coastal areas where maybe you aren't going to attract the same amount of private work, there are lots of dentists in urban areas, and coastal and rural areas and more deprived areas really struggle.
Mind you, Bristol's a fairly urban area. We've had this famous case of the dentists opening up and the queue going round the block.
Yeah, the southwest is particularly poor for dentistry. It's got a really low proportion of dentists in the southwest.
If I was an average dentist, what could I expect to earn in a year?
I think the latest figures I saw, it depends on the kind of work you do and at what stage you are in your career. Starting dentists who are training, it's probably around £40,000 a year, potentially similar to a doctor. And then if you're doing entirely private work, it could be a lot more than that, maybe like 140, something like that, I think was the latest figures I saw. But on average, close to 100,000.
Are you going to have to pay for your hygienists and so on out of that?
Dentists are private businesses. So what they're earning, pay obviously not just for their own salary, but also for their premises, for the work they need, for the extra staff and all those kinds of things. So they are running a business, a bit like GP partners who are also getting income, but not only do they use that income to pay themselves, they have to pay everybody else and all their outgoings.
And can we just take a brief look about how much actually we do spend on NHS dentistry and whether it's gone up or down over the years or stayed much the same?
So the amount has, in real terms, has stayed pretty static over the last 10 years.
Right. You wouldn't care to give a figure for that.
It's about £3 billion at the moment, but I think that figure hasn't really changed in terms of the amount that's spent because of the cost of living and changes in inflation. The actual real cost and the real spend on NHS dentistry has remained particularly flat.
But the population size hasn't remained flat.
No, it hasn't.
So the amount of money per person in the population has gone down.
Yes.
Becky Baird, that's how NHS dentistry was born and how it developed. Now, let's find out more about those dental deserts, the areas where the shortages of NHS dentists are most acute. Ian Mills is Associate Professor of Primary Care Dentistry at the Peninsula Dental School in Plymouth. Ian Mills, if you could put some flags in a map for us, can you give us a rough idea of how many of these so-called dental deserts that Becky Baird mentioned earlier there actually are and roughly where they are?
The dental deserts that probably are well recognised are the rural and coastal areas around England in particular, if we're focusing on England. And they tend to be places like Devon and Cornwall, Cumbria, Lancashire, Norfolk, Suffolk, Lincolnshire. And they tend to have been identified as areas where there's specific need for increased access for NHS dentistry.
Right. Now, when we talk about them being dental deserts, what are we really meaning? How scarce is dental provision in some of these places?
Well, non-existent if it's a new patient, so someone moving into the area. So a place like Devon has been identified as having no practices which are currently accepting new adult patients. So it's about really about NHS access to dental provision if and when you want it.
So let me be clear. If I decide that I want to uproot and I want to go to Devon, I am absolutely not going to be able to get on any dentist NHS lists. That's it. Everything I do will have to be private. And if I haven't got the money, then I just won't get the dentistry.
It's probably not quite as black and white as that, but most NHS dental practices are working at capacity in terms of the number of patients they can see. They are underperforming in terms of their unit of dental activity targets, in terms of their performance, but that is largely due to difficulty of recruitment and retention of the dental workforce.
I want to get this absolutely clear. The problem is actually there aren't enough dentists, you say. It isn't that dentists actually don't particularly want to take on NHS patients.
It's both. It's in rural areas, there is a shortage of dentists, but that's particularly acute within the NHS. So if you're trying, as a dental practice owner, if you're trying to recruit a dentist within a rural area, it is difficult whether that is private or NHS. Within the NHS, that is a huge, huge problem. And more dentists are moving or shifting across from NHS to private. So it's difficult to retain dentists within the NHS, even if you've managed to recruit some of them.
Do we have any idea what state people's teeth essentially are getting into?
Well, there's many examples of patients who have taken matters into their own hands where they've had to try and take their own tooth out, or more commonly, they turn up at their GP practice or in casualty. Most dental disease is preventable. And the problem is if you don't get early treatment or intervention, if you have got a problem, it becomes increasingly complex and increasingly complicated.
Are there any conditions where you can't have them treated unless you've had your dentistry done first? And if you haven't had your dentistry done, you can't get them treated?
In terms of general health or general medicine, that's an important point. And we've had experience in North Devon where patients at the breast cancer care unit have had chemotherapy delayed because they've been unable to access an oral health check beforehand, which is an absolute travesty. I mean, that has massive implications in terms of the treatment, but also for the emotional state of that patient if they are having potentially life-saving treatment and it's been delayed.
Yeah. Now, if people do badly need to access dental help in one of these areas, what lengths are they going to try and get it? I mean, you've mentioned that they will go to A&E, they'll go to GPs, and GPs will kind of refer them. But do they go, dentist shopping out of their area?
Well, I guess that's one of the challenges that we have within rural and coastal areas, is that if you're in a large metropolitan area, you might be able to access a dentist who's half a mile away or a mile away because of the concentration of dental practices in that area. In Devon, North Devon in particular, you might be looking at a 50-mile round trip. And dental disease tends to be more prevalent within the more disadvantaged in society. And they're potentially those that are going to be relying on public transport. And to try and get across a county like Devon to access services is a huge barrier to accessing care.
Can we talk about how dental deserts came to be dental deserts in the first place? Why won't dentists work in these places?
There are a number of issues. I mean, one is a lot of young graduates want to live in an urban or metropolitan area once they qualify. So it's difficult to recruit young graduates to an area, a rural area, and then it can be difficult to retain them as well. So we have to think about that, about what we do at an undergraduate level, and also look at the training opportunities that we can put in place. That might address some of the geographical distribution of dentists, but it won't address the shortfall within the NHS. And that is a separate issue, and that's around the NHS dental contract.
You're a professor of dentistry at the Peninsula Dental School in Plymouth. You've talked about the Southwest. Does it make a difference having a dental school in a place like that in order to not just to attract the students, but also to keep some of them in the area?
Absolutely, it does. And there are other benefits to it other than just retaining the workforce, you know, in terms of education, in terms of community engagement, you know, outreach programs. But it's true to say that, you know, still a large number of our cohort that come out of Peninsula come from Birmingham, Manchester, London, and they tend to go back there after they qualify. And there are things that we can probably do around admissions or applications and encouraging people from the rural communities to consider a career within dentistry.
Now, obviously, you're in day-to-day touch with dentistry students as they are today. What do you understand to be their attitudes about working within the NHS?
Sadly, not very encouraging. Again, an older cohort of dentists like myself viewed a career in the NHS, you know, that's what they would have for the rest of their life. I think younger graduates coming through now will simply see the NHS as a stepping stone. They are concerned that it's a bit of a treadmill on the NHS, and it's more of a focus on quantity rather than quality. There are huge opportunities now beyond the healthcare element in terms of cosmetic treatment, and that there's huge demand within the public for these treatments. They are available across the UK, but of course they tend to be centred perhaps more in urban and metropolitan areas, so students are attracted to that. So there's many factors to it, but there's no doubt that young graduates are moving more readily across into the private sector and much earlier within their career.
Ian Mills. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the episode on why councils are going broke and the one on the world's collapsing birth rates. Now, back to dentists. We know how NHS treatment is funded and why many believe the system has contributed to a drop in the number of dentists who accept NHS work. But what might we be doing about it? Here to explore this with me are Professor Claire Stevens, spokesperson for the British Society of Paediatric Dentistry, and Thea Stein, chief executive of the Nuffield Trust. Thea Stein, how would you describe the state of dentistry in England today?
Pretty dreadful, actually. In our report where we talked about NHS dentistry, which came out just before Christmas, we said it was really gone for good. And without radical action, the drift and the decay would continue unchecked.
Claire Stevens, what we've seen is that our significant problem is whether or not we have dentists who will do NHS work or enough of it. How do you think we should go about enticing dentists to come back to doing NHS work?
I think that we need to look urgently at dental contract reform. That is the major driver of the current hemorrhage that we're seeing of dentists leaving the NHS for their clinical work. We know that there are a lot of dentists out there who aren't practicing any NHS dentistry, and that's not a matter of greed. That's a matter of actually trying to keep businesses afloat and running and being able to adequately care for the vulnerable groups of a population that we would wish to care for.
The government announced a plan to try and improve things in England this week. If you could just remind us briefly what's in it, and then we can talk about how far it matches up to the scale of the problem.
Of course. The measures include things like a new patient payment, so anywhere between £15 and £50 per patient, depending on their treatment need. They're talking about 2.5 million additional NHS appointments, having a Smile for Life programme, which is around advice for new parents and supporting schools with toothbrushing and topical fluoride varnish and advice. and also one-off payments to NHS dentists of around £20,000 to encourage them to work in the so-called dental deserts for around 3 years. There's also mention of increasing the UDA value so that the minimum payment is around £28 instead of £23. And there's also talk of water fluoridation, so community water fluoridation in the northeast, and dental vans going out to rural and coastal communities.
Is there any extra payment for patients who might need more complex dental work?
There isn't any mention of dental contract reform in the plans that we saw yesterday.
Thank you, Claire, for outlining that for us. Athea, what can we say about how far that programme matches the problems that we think we've got and that seem to be growing?
I think you've probably seen a range of commentators, including ourselves, say it doesn't really touch the sides. You know, don't get me wrong, anything in the situation that we face at the moment around dental is to be welcomed. But we did describe it as a bit of a scale and polish when what was needed was really root canal work. There isn't enough in this that brings us back from the brink. The amount of money that's there, remember, the amount of money that's being talked about is non-recurrent as well. So if you're somebody who takes on this new patient this year, you've got nothing that tells you you're going to be paid and remunerated at a similar level or at a better level in years to come. You've got £20,000 as a golden hello, but you've got to be in place in a rural area for 3 years. Is that really going to incentivize people to make quite a significant and big leap? It's partial. It's partial.
So let me just be absolutely clear. Those aspects which are to do with prevention, like the dental teams visiting schools and nurseries, I imagine, Claire Stevens, are entirely admirable and should go in with a kind of broader picture of preventative care.
Well, actually, on the surface, they look good. But when you look at the detail, they're not quite evidence-based. And actually, it's not what I would be recommending had I been asked about this. I would be looking at the supervised toothbrushing. So let's pick that up first of all. That is an intervention with known evidence base and known return on investment. So I would absolutely support that. But going into schools to provide checkups and fluoride varnish is not going to deliver an oral health benefit. I mean, if you think about a child who is potentially in pain, what that child needs is access to urgent dental care, and they need to be rendered dentally fit. So I feel a little confused, actually.
I have to say, it's a slightly dismal picture that you're both painting here. Firstly, that the money simply isn't going to be enough to attract dentists to places that don't have dentists already. Second, that the money's not going to be enough to get them to do treatments that they're not doing already on the NHS. And thirdly, that even the preventive measures actually don't add significantly to what we've already got. Is that a fair summary, Thea, of what you think?
Yes, really, it is pretty dismal. But I equally don't want to say it's not an attempt to do something, because frankly, we are in such a terrible situation that an attempt to do something is better than where we were, which was with nothing. But I am concerned that there will be a belief now, potentially amongst the general public, that, oh, things will be okay, I'll be able to get a dentist. I'll have a dentist and that will be my dentist and they will provide easy, accessible care for me. And that's what the public want. And this dental action plan won't deliver that.
OK, let's imagine that I'm a new Secretary of State for Health and I call you both in and I say, look, what is it that we should be doing to stop the deterioration in our dental health and to turn it into an improvement in our dental health? What are the changes that we should make, Thea?
So I'm afraid I'm not going to be upbeat and optimistic again here, but we would say that the drift to private dental care for those who can afford it has now gone so far that you need, as a new Secretary of State, to be extremely thoughtful about, are you really going to bring back universal coverage of dental care for the whole population for everything, because that will cost you billions against other priorities you've got. But what you must do is focus on those groups who are vulnerable. It's about 24% of the population, those who are young, those who live in poverty, those on benefits, those who are pregnant, and to make sure that they have absolutely comprehensive dental care. Then maybe you have to be very honest with the public that you may get emergency dental care or a checkup, but there may be means testing, as there is, for example, for a prescription for other access to dental care. We're not sure even the most recent branch changes to the contract is going to bring back universal dental care for everybody, and that actually there will not be an appetite in the Treasury or elsewhere to do that when so many people have already chosen private care.
Claire Stevens, what do you make of that?
Yes, it's a difficult conversation to have, isn't it? Because in an ideal world, you would have a comprehensive service that was available for everybody. But as Thea said, that is extremely expensive to deliver. In terms of accessing core groups, that is absolutely the right thing to do. A targeted approach to those most in need and then a gradient of support thereafter. And, you know, NHS England is already well ahead with that in terms of oral health is one of the five clinical areas as identified as needing a radical change and improvement. And sometimes it's about really integrating oral health services with other health and social care services. So, for example, rather than expecting that family to go into a dental practice, is there a way of reaching them earlier, for example, through a health visitor? So it is right that we identify these children and put that blanket of support around them in preference, perhaps, to another family or an adult who might be far less vulnerable.
Thea, what about recruitment of dentists?
The interesting fact is we actually do have a lot of dentists. We have 44,000 dentists in England. We only have 24,151 who do NHS activity. So what we need to do is recruit dentists and the dental workforce, which is the wider dental workforce, at a wider and bigger scale for the future. The long-term workforce plan commits to expanding dentistry training places by 24%.
That was a plan the government announced last year, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And the issue, of course, though, is there has to be some form of golden handcuff or golden tie-in, which I believe is being explored, around ensuring those expanded dental places lead to people working within NHS dentistry. Because as I said, we have a lot of dentists in England, but what we don't have is a commensurate rise of the number of dentists that we have working in NHS care.
Thea Stein there with Claire Stevens. My thanks to them and to Becky Baird and Ian Mills. And my conclusion is that it sounds like we probably need a big rethink of how we pay for and even think about our dental health. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Nick Holland, Kirsty Knight and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineer was James Beard. The editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I think the power of the show was crazy back then.
The X Factor promised to turn ordinary people into pop stars.
We stood there behind the doors when 16 million people are about to watch you go on stage. And Simon just stood next to you like, good luck, girls, good luck.
I'm Chi-Chi Zundu. For years, I was a BBC showbiz journalist who covered every twist and turn. I want to go behind the scenes to find out from staff and contestants what it was like.
You don't just want average people. You wanted, you know, it was so bad. They were comical.
I feel like I was humiliated just for the entertainment.
Did the show ever come back and they said to me, Sam, will you come on and do it again? I'd be like, what time do you want me?
Over six episodes, I'm looking back at the good and the bad of one of Britain's biggest TV shows. For BBC Radio 4, this is Offstage, Inside the X Factor. Listen on BBC Sounds.